يوسف جلالي بتهران.
روباشاف غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
رشا سغلام اسطنبول.
سعيد امين عالمي كابول.
شاهان بات انديان ادمنستريد كشمير.
Around the world with reporters.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shut down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
The combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hudaydah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. This situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here. And while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their park 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, but that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theatre. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution, or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen. How people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Jenny Miller, Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer, this despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy. Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but eight Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theatre the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There's a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, and did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone, has more billionaires than any other city in the world.
That's all according to UK Daily The Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country, amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super-rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Pour is up, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne. and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another massacre in the U.S., 21 killed, including 19 children. This is the 8th mass shooting in the U.S. this year so far, and it's only the month of May. Why do mass shootings in the U.S. take place in the first place, more so than any other country in the world? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will take a look at why there is not a strong enough appetite or will from U.S. lawmakers, perhaps, either whether it's Republicans or Democrats, to put an end to this wave of violence, unless what's inscribed in the Second Amendment or the powerful NRA gun lobby are the main obstacles in reaching that. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is David Swanson, who's the director of World Beyond War, who joins us from Charlottesville.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. So obviously, I'm going to start with a question from you, Gerald Horn, and ask you for a reaction to what has happened, because it's obviously very depressing and very shocking that this has happened yet again in the U.S.
It's horrible, it's terrible, but it's also predictable. It's predictable because, number one, the United States operates under an archaic and antiquated constitution from the 18th century during the era of the acceleration of the invasion of European settlers who thought that they needed weapons in order to massacre Native Americans to take their land and to import more enslaved Africans and needing weapons to keep them in line. And as you suggested, there's a Second Amendment that tends to validate that. But since then, you have this point that the right-wing movement in this country has latched onto that, because the right-wing movement in this country says that there should be no change in the antiquated interpretation of the Second Amendment, because it might be necessary at some point in the 21st century, for example, for their movement to overthrow a government that they don't approve of. And then this industry, the arms industry, is a very profitable industry. It has been described as perpetrating an iron river of weapons into Mexico, which has really been very helpful to certain kinds of drug cartels, for example. They're meeting in Houston, Texas, as I speak, and there are about 55,000 members of the National Rifle Association, which is one of the most powerful grassroots organizations in this country. And then I think that we should not distinguish the point that this movement is based upon a white supremacy, based upon this idea that those defined as white have a virtual and veritable divine right to rule over everyone else in this country. And I would also say that when you have a foreign policy of the United States which privileges this war, which routinely is involved in massacres of people in Afghanistan over the past two or three decades, or in Iraq in recent years, and other sites too numerous to mention,
okay,
that it leads to the cheapening of life. And that cheapening of life has now returned with a vengeance back to the United States of America.
So what do you think, David Swatson? You have different dynamics involved here, of which, due to lack of time, I'd like to see how you can put this into perspective for us. On the one hand, you have the lawmakers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. It seems like Democrats are more pro control of the situation in terms of gun control, for example, rather than Republicans. At the same time, you have what's been called the NRA, which, you know, like Gerald Horn said there, they're a powerful lobby group. What does that exactly mean? Can you put these things that are pulling against what should be the prevention of the loss of life?
Well, I agree with every word that Professor Horn said there. There are structural problems and there are cultural problems. There are nations on this planet with similar cultures that have fixed the problem to an extraordinary extent structurally by banning guns. And the reason that this doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. is principally that they have legalized bribery and turned it into campaign contributions and made it perfectly acceptable so that politicians are openly bought and paid for. They also have this system of two parties in which, as on many issues, on this issue, one party, the Republicans, are openly and strongly against preventing gun proliferation, and the other party claims to be for doing something, but always manages to have a handful of its members against its supposed mission, even though it has the majority, and prioritizes keeping in place archaic rules like the filibuster that require it to have a supermajority that it doesn't have. And so it will use these tragedies as campaign material. Elect even more of us and we'll do even more than the nothing that we've done so far, rather than taking action to do something about it. And you do have a culture that's been saturated with acceptance of violence. You have the U.S. government through, in this case, the U.S. Navy, funding programs in schools like the one attended by the latest shooter to entice those who can't afford college, because college has been as outpriced many people in this country, to enter a program called ROTC, where they're trained to shoot guns. Very often, these shooters in high schools have been through these programs, have been trained by the U.S. government. In fact, the famous one in Florida was wearing the T-shirt from the junior ROTC when he shot up his classmates. And very disproportionately, mass shooters across the United States are veterans of the U.S. military, of U.S. wars. And so there is a culture of violence at home and abroad that creates these vicious cycles. And it's a society saturated in both violence and guns. And unfortunately, we don't have a political system that seems capable of dealing with it unless we see a mass uprising of nonviolent action. And of course, the people of the United States are the least likely people in the world to do such a thing.
Gerald Horn, when looking through and sifting through some of the points that could have been addressed in this program, one of the things that stood out is a tweet by this one particular person, which was pretty striking when I read it, and it said, in retrospect, Sandy Hook marked the end of the U.S. gun control debate. Once America decided killing children was bearable, it was over. Now, that itself is deep in the way that it impacted at least a point of view of such for me. But then when you take a look at what could be more, even more impactful would be when you have the use of guns and how it has killed politicians. Martin Luther King, for example, Kennedy, for example, and yet we're still looking at this being an issue in the U.S. So obviously there doesn't seem to be enough of an appetite, willpower, or initiative, or whatever you'd like to call it, for this to end. How can this be channeled in order to reach a solution?
Well, that is the question, is it not? But one has to say that when you have these formidable, profound issues in the United States of America, what has helped to change the calculus has been international pressure. That's the reason why slavery ended. That's the reason why U.S. apartheid, or Jim Crow as it has been called, began to retreat. That is why the United States was ultimately driven out of Vietnam in the 1970s, for example. And I dare say that because of the formidable nature of this so-called white American population, which unites across class lines, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, and is determined to hold on to power by any means necessary. Recall that it was only a few days ago that you had this racist massacre in Buffalo, New York, where 10 black people were killed at a store. The massacre perpetrator was motivated by this idea that the demographics of the United States are changing, that people not defined as white are becoming the majority, and he was determined to overturn that by his own crude action. And so we need more international pressure against the United States, not least because even those who consider themselves to be well-intentioned in the so-called white majority oftentimes have an inadequate analysis, which leads to inadequate prescriptions, which then leads us on this vicious cycle back to killing 10-year-old children in a classroom.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
NRA is going to be coming to Texas in a matter of days, from what we understand, David Swanson. You're going to have a number of politicians speaking there. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, we understand, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and
Oh, and Donald Trump. One thing he did when he was in office was, based on some of the things I'm reading here, reversing an Obama-era policy that had to, that was dealing with restricting gun purchases by people and deemed by the Social Security Administration to be mentally unable to manage their affairs. He reversed that. So that's just a reflection of how even former U.S. president looked at the matter. Why is there such a divide when it comes to U.S. politicians or lawmakers, I should say?
You know, when you started to mention a tweet, I thought you might be going toward a recent tweet prior to this latest massacre by the governor of Texas, pushing people in Texas to buy more guns because they were shamefully in second place behind California. There's a culture of love for guns. It's not a necessary evil. They're celebrated. The more guns, the better. And it's a cultural identity, a partisan political identity. In the hour before we were speaking, saw that same Texas governor have a press conference interrupted by the Democrat who had run for governor against him, demanding that something be done about guns. This a complete, almost worthless, sellout corporate moderate Democrat candidate, but even he willing to say something about guns, at least until he can get himself into office. You have a congressional race, a Democratic primary happening right now, the votes being counted in Texas, between a Democrat who's, you know, worthless on most issues but willing to take a stand on guns, and the incumbent Democrat who's absolutely against doing anything about guns, and you have the Democratic leadership in Washington, D.C. doing everything they can to keep that incumbent in office, even while claiming that they are the ones against guns. And so you have this endless hypocritical compromising from the Democrats, and this cultural celebration of guns as a wonderful, heroic things. If you don't have weapons of war in your house, the government is going to come get you. You know, this government that can't tie its own shoes. And so there is a cultural divide, and there is, a political logjam.
Yeah, and some of the stats that I'm looking at, David Swanson, which points to the question that I want to ask you, I'm sorry, Gerald Horn, is the fact that, so you have these massacres, eight of them so far, by the way, and it's only May, as I mentioned in the intro, people are dying from gun violence on a daily basis in the U.S., daily basis. Now, this particular source talks about 45,000, somewhat, maybe 45,800 injuries that include deaths, but it doesn't get into the complete number. It says 2020 is the furthest of this database that they have. But anyways, if it is such an issue, which it is, this gun culture and how guns lead to deaths and people are using it to kill each other, why isn't it highlighted more throughout the media in the U.S. on a weekly basis, I don't know, on news channels, or more education perhaps on it in schools, et cetera? Is that happening and still not working?
It is happening to a degree. It needs to happen more. But I have to repeat what I said a moment or two ago. The ultimate problem is the fact that this gun culture comes from the bloody history of the United States of America, the history of a European invasion, where the people who were not only rich, but the people who were poor and were settlers and defined as white, were armed so that they could kill Native Americans. I'm sitting here in Texas. 200 years ago, this land was teeming with indigenous populations, particularly the Comanches. They've all been liquidated, exterminated. And so that helped to create this culture. And then, as I said before, you have to keep the black population in line, which is still happening to this very day. Many of our liberal friends buy into the mythology about the Constitution and the so-called sacred founding of the United States in 1776, which prevents them from dealing and grappling honestly with this bloody history. Instead, they blame political parties, which of course are ultimately dependent upon this same majority white electorate, which I've just excoriated. And so until we are able to deal honestly with this history, we will be continually
let's go with that line. Let's go with that line that you're talking about. Dave Swanson, last question. God forbid that any type of social crisis, which the U.S. is teetering on, breaks out in terms of a civil unrest of a massive scale, large in numbers in the U.S., where you have guns almost outnumbering the people. Isn't the U.S. government worried about something like that happening? 30 seconds.
I don't think there's a grave danger of that happening. I do think there is a grave danger of these shootings continuing and multiplying and of the continuation of nothing being done in Washington, D.C. But in terms of a violent uprising in the United States, I don't think it's much more likely than a nonviolent one, which is what we actually need, but is extremely unlikely due to the disempowerment in people's own minds.
Thank you, David Swanson, director of the World Beyond War at Charlottesville. Darrell Horn, thank you, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tabwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Survey data estimates there were 28 to 31 million uninsured people in the U.S. in 2020, and as many as 14.4 million people will be at risk of losing their health insurance coverage when the public health emergency ends. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sakshi Odovant Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Uninsured American People Are Left Behind. Here's more. After 2 years of free COVID-19 tests, vaccinations, and other healthcare resources during the pandemic, the U.S. government has run out of funding. Last month, the Biden administration wrote a letter to Congress asking lawmakers to provide $22.5 billion to keep the funding programs running across the U.S. Without the additional funding, it will leave Americans unequipped to deal with a future surge, the letter read. Since January 2022, more than 60 million households across the U.S. have ordered free at-home COVID-19 tests and had access to free testing sites across 21,500 locations around the country. U.S. residents also received free vaccinations and booster shots at 90,000 locations across the country. Moreover, areas populated by communities of color and low-income families have the highest demand for federally funded COVID-19 care. Those who don't use the clinics offered by the government typically go to hospitals, pharmacies, or health clinics for COVID-19-related services. But without the U.S. government funding, people without health insurance have limited options for seeking care and are forced to look for community-based care options, find providers willing to absorb the bill or pay out of the pocket. In the administration's letter to Congress, officials said it will be too late if Congress waits until there is another surge to provide funding. The letter also addresses several consequences arising from the lack of sustained funding, some of which include not having enough booster shots, a lack of funding to research additional vaccines that could provide protection against future variants, scaling back preventive treatments for the immunocompromised individuals and being blindsided by future variants. Not only will the lack of funding affect currently infected individuals in the U.S., but it also increases the possibility of a spread, putting more of the population at risk, said Dr. George C. Benjamin, the executive director of the American Public Health Association, adding, "This can raise the chance of more threatening variants becoming widespread." Despite repeated requests, additional COVID-19 resources haven't been approved. Instead, Republican senators are asking the administration for a detailed account of how the previous round of funding was spent. Without government funding, the cost for a COVID-19 test can run from between $20 to $850, with $127 being the median cost. There has recently been a reduced demand from citizens who can no longer afford to pay for COVID-19 tests and other healthcare resources out of pocket, which has made it increasingly difficult for some testing sites to operate. As a result, many states and healthcare organizations have resorted to shutting down. New Hampshire closed all state-managed COVID-19 vaccination sites at the end of March, stating vaccination numbers were high enough. In San Diego, officials closed the Jacobs Center vaccination site because of a decline in requests for testing and vaccination, and instead opened up mobile clinics. For now, they are still offering tests free of charge despite federal funding running out. Embry Health, a leading COVID-19 testing provider in Arizona, recently announced it would suspend testing at 60 sites and ask individuals without insurance to pay $100 for COVID-19 tests and $200 for rapid PCR tests at the remaining locations. Embry was paying for the uninsured to get tests after the government funding stopped on March 22, 2022, but as of April 2nd can no longer afford to do so, the company said in a statement. CDR Health, a Florida-based company that offered COVID-19 tests to nearly 15,000 people a day during surges, has also closed down all 30 of its free testing centers due to lack of funding. Survey data estimates there were 28 to 31 million uninsured people in the U.S. in 2020, and as many as 14.4 million people will be at risk of losing their health insurance coverage when the public health emergency ends. So while paid testing will continue to be available, it won't be affordable or accessible for everyone, especially for marginalized communities who already face systematic healthcare bias. In the U.S., communities of color and low-income families accounted for a disproportionate number of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and experts say the lack of funding will further widen these health and economic inequities. Low-income communities and uninsured individuals, which often includes communities of color, are at the greatest risk because they will not have the financial means or insurance protections to cover vaccinations, testing, and healthcare if the federal government runs out of money to pay for them, Benjamin said. The majority of the U.S. population has received their COVID-19 vaccination doses by now. Data from Bloomberg's COVID-19 vaccination tracker shows 567 million doses have been administered as of April 13th. This may partially explain why fewer people are visiting vaccination centers, but experts warn this does not mean the pandemic is over or that there is no more need for doses or testing. Benjamin said if the BA2 variant causes big outbreaks or there is a new variant spreading, we will not be prepared for another surge of infections without federal funding. Without the required funding, the U.S. government is unable to purchase further life-saving monoclonal antibody medicines or provide boosters, shots, and other variant-specific immunizations, said Lyle Solomon, a principal attorney at Oakview Law Group. Solomon added, there will be a gradual reduction in the money available to pay doctors and other healthcare providers who treat those uninsured. In situations like these, healthcare providers will need to absorb the cost of uninsured patients or turn them away, which will widen the gap in access to necessary care. Not having access to free tests and vaccinations will only reduce the number of people getting the shot, which will become a major problem if cases increase again or if a new variant arises. Benjamin said, we are still not at the optimal level of vaccination, including booster shots.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.